This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740.
Canada, The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
First of all, a thank you to Victor Vigiani for sitting in last week while I enjoyed some Thanksgiving dinner with my family back in Brantford, Ontario. Brantford, not to be confused with Bradford, Pennsylvania, our new affiliate. WESB News Radio 1490, Bradford, Pennsylvania, which is, I believe, in the northern part of the state, just about maybe an hour's drive south of Buffalo, New York. So News Radio 1490, welcome aboard, and glad to be a part of WESB. That's number 25, our 25th U.S. affiliate. So strike up the band. I tell you, what a memorable evening it has been already, and we haven't even started the show, or barely we've started the show. I walk in, not that you need to hear my troubles, Lord, the world has enough of its own. However, I just thought you'd find this somewhat, I don't know, amusing. I have my routine, right? First thing I do is I walk in the door and I go into the mailroom, which is just off the lobby. And I've got some interesting mail to share with you, to say the least, a little bit later if we have time. Then I head into the kitchen to get my cup of green tea, and I usually grab a cup of coffee for George Chunescu, who is hosting the program that precedes mine, Big Band Sunday Night, here on our flagship station, AM 740. The coffee machine is on the fritz, not working, no lights, no doodads, nothing flashing. You know, tried to replug it in. Nothing would work. Anyway, so no tea, no coffee. Fine. Okay, I can live with that. So then I'm walking down to the studio, my next stop. And what do I hear behind me? Nothing that I expected to hear. Grrr. Just like that. Grrr. So I turn around slowly. And I don't know, I was flashing back a couple of weeks ago. I was watching Clash of the Titans with the boys. And I remember that scene when Pericles is trying to get into Medusa's lair and he's attacked by this three-headed dog. I don't know, I had this vision. I turned around and sure enough, there's this mangy-looking dog. He has a collar. And he's slowly walking towards me. And his tail ain't wagging. Just grrr. And I'm thinking, what the heck is going on here? This is supposed to happen in some back alley, but not in the halls of Zoomer Radio. So, you know, I'm trying to stay calm. And I'm talking to the dog like an idiot. I'm saying, and oh, aren't you a cute little puppy? Who do you belong to? While I'm backing away slowly and grrr. So anyway, finally, someone pops out of a studio, a gentleman here I've never met before, works here in the building somewhere, grabbed the dog by the collar and said, and was very apologetic and very embarrassed and said, I'm sorry, I'm working here. I had the dog in the studio. He got out. I apologize anyway. So here I am, barely, almost torn limb from limb. You see what obstacles I have to go through just to get to this studio to deliver the truth to you each and every night? All right. Welcome to the program. Listen, let's just jump right in, shall we? Enough about me. Let's talk about life out there because it's, you know, it's pretty gloomy. Let's take a look backstage in the Global Theater as we do from time to time with our good friend, political scientist, specializing in the philosophy of law and constitutional theory, and of course, the editor and publisher of a very important news analysis service, a weekly news analysis service called World Affairs Brief, which is dedicated to providing an understanding of the secret or hidden actions behind world leaders. Joel Skousen joins us. How are you, my friend?
Fine, Richard. It's good to be with you.
Good to have you aboard. Listen, we've just gone through this whole debt ceiling debacle. It's the song that never ends. Of course, they again kick the can down the road, and we'll revisit that in a moment. But with all of this, talk about the debt, the one big story that has sort of been silenced is Syria, and you address that in your recent edition of World Affairs Brief. What's going on with Syria?
Well, this is a rare occurrence that has happened, is when the globalist juggernaut for war, which was clearly heading steamroller type, juggernaut heading for Syria. Everybody knew that the U.S. was bent on attacking Syria. Everything was on schedule. They were just looking for the right provocation. They had it in the falsification of a chemical weapons attack near Damascus, and it was falsified, and nobody knew how to stop it, except that Secretary of State John Kerry was in London giving a press conference, and a reporter just said, "Hey, is there anything Syria can do to stop this?" Meaning, it looks like you're just hell-bent on going in there. Is there anything Syria can do? Oh, yeah, they could give up their chemical weapons, but they're never going to do that, and that would stop it. And boy, I'll tell you, the Russians jumped on it. We accept. And Syria jumped on it. We accept. And they were stuck. And I'll tell you, there was hell to pay for Kerry at the White House for loose lips there. And
I'm sure I'm surprised he survived that, actually. That was a major blunder. Amateur hour.
Absolute puppets like that, they're useful idiots, believe it or not, are rare. And they would have had a lot of egg on their face had they dumped Kerry over that. They had to maintain appearances, and that's why he stayed on. But clearly he's been damaged in their eyes by this. And they've been scrambling ever since. They went next to the UN and tried to say, I want a war resolution so that if there's any glitch whatsoever in this agreement, that we can go to war without any further resolution. And they wouldn't buy it. The Russians wouldn't buy it. They threatened to veto, so they didn't get that. And so what happens this week is that Kerry comes up and says, we have to have an urgent peace agreement. We require that the Syrian opposition set up a transition government here. We're going to force the Syrian government to come in and negotiate with this transition government. And for all of a sudden, everyone's saying, wait a minute, we're in the middle of a chemical weapons decommissioning deal here, which is going to take years. And you're now demanding, an instantaneous peace conference. And what's been going on, of course, is that the Syrian opposition has fallen apart. They've got factional infighting. The Syrian army is moving against them, and basically the Syrian opposition hasn't made any progress since this. And they were actually losing the war even before this. That's why the U.S. had to engender a falsified chemical weapons strike by Syria against their own people, which was ludicrous.
Joel Skousen with us, editor and publisher of World Affairs Brief. And you talk about the Syrian opposition, which is largely made up of insurgents from outside the country and, of course, an element of al-Qaeda, all being propped up by the U.S., NATO, and their Arab allies.
That's right, and made up also of those that were malcontents within the army, the corrupt, the other people. They said, this is our chance to get back at Assad and the other powers that be in Syria, and so they joined. And Assad was very open in an interview with Der Spiegel about it. We were actually glad to get rid of those people, and a lot of those people are dying because they're fighting for the opposition, but they were the corrupt people, and they said, we had problems with them, and a lot of the mistakes that were made by Syria is not on my orders, but because these particular people went off the reservation and killed some civilians and did some other damage, and, that gets blamed on us.
I recently saw online on YouTube a series of interviews that President Bashar al-Assad of Syria did with the Western press, including Charlie Rose. And when you listen to Assad speak, and he speaks English quite well, he sounds like a statesman. And I mean, I know I'm not that naive. You know, he has to rule with an iron fist there. He's not atypical of leaders in the Middle East, strong men, but he's certainly no crazed, you know, dictator. And when you hear him speak about, you know, the one thing that jumped out at me immediately was that he said that back in the early 2000s, he had committed Syria at the UN to get rid of all of their weapons of mass destruction, which included chemical weapons, although they didn't openly admit they had chemical weapons for reasons of national security. So the idea of getting rid of those was his originally.
Well, let me just clarify and give you my opinion of Assad. Now, remember, Syria, like all these Middle Eastern, is ruled by a lot of strong people. They aren't necessarily the president. Now, his father was a strong man ruler, and he's the one who set up the system. There was a lot of corruption. There was a lot of dealing with the West and the Western intelligence services. They did a lot of nasty things. They did rule with an iron hand. Assad is Western educated, medical educated. He's a much softer individual. He inherited the power system his father established. And what happens is, in Syria, he's having to deal with the powers that be, basically. And he's having, you know, he inherited, he's got to be the head of state, trying to, but he realized there is only so much that I can change in that. If he himself would rather, much rather be a Democrat. He would much rather be fully democratic, like without the power structure, without the secret police, without those types of things. That's his preferences. So there is a difference between he and his father. And that's why he comes up so rational, because he is. But he is caught between a rock and a hard spot. I've, you know, inherited this position. I've got, you know, some really strong people. There are some bad things that go on in the government, and I only have certain limitations of what I can change at any one time.
So then the question is, why can't the United States, why can't they, why won't they work with Assad? There was a picture that was released online not too long ago, which showed then Senator John Kerry and his wife having dinner with Assad and his wife, you know, in a it wasn't didn't look like a working dinner. It looked like a very social, kind of cordial event. And then the next thing we know, you know, Kerry is calling Assad some bloodthirsty, you know, tin pot dictator. So what happened, and why do they want Assad out so badly?
Well, it isn't because of Assad. It has nothing to do with Assad. The reason is they want Syria to – they want the old guard destroyed in Syria that is underneath Assad, and Assad is merely the figurehead that they can paint. And they're having a difficult time painting him as the dictator because he isn't that. And Kerry knows that. Everybody who deals with Assad knows that this guy isn't a dictator. Even when you read the Der Spiegel interview that I talked about in the World Affairs Brief, it's very obvious these guys come in there from Germany with an axe to grind. And they are just, they're not neutral at all. You're a dictator. You're this and that. You've killed people. And I said, wait a minute. Where's the evidence of that, you know? You know, he defends himself very, very well in this Der Spiegel, and they come out looking just like they are, a hatchet man trying to crucify the guy, and he just won't have anything of it. It is just an amazing defense. That's why the U.S. media won't put much of Assad on television. I mean, Charlie Rose made a big mistake. He came out looking very bad, very aggressive in this interview, and Assad came out looking like the reasonable person. But here's what they're after.
Just let me jump in here, Joel, because we'll take a timeout. We'll come back. We'll continue to talk about Syria. We'll talk about the U.S. debt ceiling debacle and what it means for the rest of the world, and whether the U.S. dollar will lose its world reserve currency, and much more. Joel Skousen from World Affairs Brief right here on The Conspiracy Show. Don't go away. We're just kind of scrabbling around backstage in the Global Theater. Thank God Joel Skousen brought his flashlight. He's the publisher and editor of World Affairs Brief, a weekly news analysis service dedicated to providing an understanding of the secret or hidden actions of government leaders. And Joel, how can people subscribe?
Well, they can go to worldaffairsbrief.com. There's a big subscribe button. They can see a synopsis of the current brief, and then get a free sample copy before they subscribe by simply emailing me at editor at worldaffairsbrief.com. And there's plenty of free things to read on the website as well. And when they subscribe, they get access to all 20 years of the archives.
20 years. Wow, that's quite an accomplishment. Congratulations. And I've linked up to your site at richardserrett.com. They just go to the homepage and under guest, just click on Joel Skousen. That'll take you right there. So subscribing is easy as 1, 2, 3. We were talking about Syria, and it's been quiet there lately. Syria has been very cooperative in this long-term decommissioning of all their chemical weapons. And so the question remains, given all that, why do they want Assad out, and why do they seem to be ready to start resuming their saber-rattling?
Well, the main target is Iran, because Iran is the only Muslim nation in the region, really, that is developing its own indigenous weapon systems. And for years, ever since World War One, the Ottoman Empire was in decline, and the British came in and started, and the Germans started to arm the Ottomans, and the British started to arm the Arabs. The Arabs have been cannon fodder for the East and the West, basically trying to use them and misuse them and create a lot of bad blood. But as long as they have all their weapons supplied from outside, either from the West or the East, the Muslims are cannon fodder. They're just tools to be used in this globalist hegemonic battle that we're experiencing. Iran's trying to break that mold. Iran's trying to have their own indigenous weapon system. They've got enough oil and money to do it. They've made a lot of strides. That's why they're targeted for the takedown. And I think they are trying to create nuclear weapons. If I knew that the globalists had me in their sights, you know, I'd probably want, you know, the best weapons that were out there, too, as a deterrence. But what is happening is that even though Iran is the target, Syria has the highest retaliatory capacity against Israel. Israel has been tasked ever since 2004 by the globalists in a meeting in London to take out Iran. And they have not been able to do it. They've not been able to provoke Iran into a sufficient excuse to attack. But Israel is now giving all the signals that they're getting ready to attack Iran, and I think that's what's related to Kerry's increased saber-rattling and demands for a peace conference, because basically they're going to put down conditions that Assad cannot accept. They're going to show him as recalcitrant. They're going to try to whip up public opinion against him in some way, try to induce either Assad or someone justifying military intervention. They may be able to control Syria by the virtue of the fact they have all these people in there doing weapons and decommissioning. But Assad still has a tremendous amount of firepower. He's got over 1,000 Scud missiles with conventional warheads. He can play mincemeat with their Iron Dome anti-missile system. You just can't stop, you know, more than about 10 missiles at a time. And they are capable of launching salvos of 1,000. Combined with Hezbollah, with their thousands of smaller rockets, this could be a real tough thing. That's why Syria has to go down. But I'll tell you, frankly, it's going to be a bloodbath in Syria if they let those opposition jihadists go in there. They've got a grudge match. They have shown already they've beheaded people, they've drank their blood, eaten heart. You know, these people are ruthless. And the U.S. is going to be totally responsible for bringing in the most ruthless bloodbath to Syria. And it's no wonder the people in Damascus are just really fearful and hateful of the United States financing this future bloodbath, and I don't think it's going to turn out well for Syria.
Well, Senator Rand Paul has talked openly about the fact that the United States or the Obama administration is backing al-Qaeda. A few others have talked about it, but why isn't the mainstream media all over this? I mean, this, to me, for those who believe al-Qaeda was responsible for 9/11, I mean, why can't people seem to connect the dots? You know, here they're supposed to be, you know, the sworn enemy of the United States, and yet here they are supporting al-Qaeda in Syria.
Well, you know, if I have to be frank, and it's hard to make these statements without all the backup information, but I make them anyway, but the United States government controls al-Qaeda at the top. It's a CIA creation ever since the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. It's financed through Saudi Arabia and now Qatar. And these, you know, Arab countries that are aligned with this globalist agenda are providing the funds and most of the weapons and funds coming into Syria are through Saudi Arabia and Qatar. And so, you know, the United States is playing both sides, and that doesn't mean that all Al-Qaeda people are understanding, or even a few are understanding, that the CIA through the ISI or the Saudis are the ones who provide, you know, our money and that ultimately control us. Like any terrorist organization, they hire a lot of bad guys, and those bad guys don't know who's controlling the top. So it's a very convoluted, very complex thing to understand when you talk about our government both fights a drug war and energizes and pays for and controls a drug pipeline, a major drug pipeline. The U.S. fights terrorism on one side and controls and use terrorism for false flag operations. But I'll be very clear, 9/11 was not pulled off by Al-Qaeda. Those buildings were brought down by demolition, controlled demolition. This was a U.S. operation, a black operation from beginning to end. And I've got the proof for it. I'm putting out a documentary next year on the history of conspiratorial power, and from 1900 through the present. It's going to be a phenomenal synopsis of all of these things with enough backup evidence to provide proof for every reasonable people to understand what's going on.
Well, we can look forward to that, and we'll definitely have you back on to discuss that in at full length. Now, let's shift from Syria and talk about, you know, yes, the United States averted default, supposedly, although I don't necessarily believe that that would have been the case. But they, you know, this debt ceiling, they've extended that. So now the U.S. debt ceiling has been raised to, what, $17 trillion. I was watching Judge Andrew Napolitano, a guy that I have a lot of time for on Fox, talking about the debt ceiling and really put it into perspective for me. He said that back in I believe it was 1917, President Woodrow Wilson, they borrowed $30 billion to pay for the war effort during World War I, and they still haven't paid one penny of that back. To put it in perspective, that's the kind of, you know, financial mismanagement we have in the United States. But what's really at stake here for the rest of the world? This constant kicking the can down, you know, the road, never dealing with the serious debt problem. $17 trillion, but if you look at unfunded liabilities, you're and if
121 trillion.
Then you include the state debt and consumer debt. You're looking at probably close to $200 trillion.
Yeah. But let me understand. Let me first of all explain philosophically. You have to understand why this debt problem is never going away. This is the way in which you reduce political resistance to unpopular programs, is that you don't tax them for it. You simply deficit spend. Politicians love deficit spending. If we taxed people for the war in Afghanistan and gave them a bill for $5,000 a year for every man, woman, and child in the country, there would be a rebellion in the steps of Congress demanding to stop. If you gave them a bill for $1,000 for foreign aid, there would be a rebellion. You see, these things are popular as long as you don't tax people, as long as they don't have to pay the pain, and that's why we never intend to pay them off. This is something that's just going to roll forward until it reaches a crisis, and that ticking time bomb is somewhere around 2028 right now, where you don't have enough tax money to pay for the interest on the debt, then you're technically bankrupt. But I'm here to tell you they plan to give us a third world war before then, and that's going to give them cover. The whole thing about it, the threat of an economic collapse, the dollar using its reserve currency is bogus. And so is the concept that they put out in the press about come this Thursday, the U.S. will not be able to pay its obligations. That is baloney. They had enough money. They were nowhere near default. What they would have, you know, obviously had to make some choices. And this is the problem in the United States, is that Congress was given the purse strings, the House of Representatives in particular, being closest to representatives of the people. But the president's given the power to implement what Congress, and basically they should be impeaching this president for not spending the money according to how Congress has dictated, because Congress has the power to dictate. But they so destroyed the impeachment process during the Clinton impeachment, they so made a laughingstock that nobody wants to go through that again. And that's what happened with the debt ceiling crisis this time, which I covered in the World Affairs Brief. they actually, and Boehner was, House Speaker John Boehner is responsible for the strategy. He's not a Tea Party conservative. He's not even a conservative. He is a globalist. He works for the other side. But he played along with the Tea Party conservatives that he was going to fight Obamacare and going to do all this. And they just rallied and thought, hey, he's doing a great job for us. And then he sabotaged it. He walked away from this thing after he bloodied the conservatives. He didn't rebut any of the arguments on television. He made an agreement with Obama that he wouldn't criticize each other, which only accrued to the favor of Obama because your only defense as Republicans was to say how Obama didn't have to shut down these things to inconvenience people. He was purposely inconvenienced. And so they walked away with nothing and so embittered the nation about it that they will have no political capital to be able to do a debt crisis thing again in January when it runs out again. They're just simply going to be set up to capitulate because everyone will say, you can't put us through this debt crisis. You can't put us through a government shutdown again. It wasn't a shutdown. There was 83% of the government was operating normally, but the part that was shut down needed to be shut down in large part. A lot of these bureaucrats that are totally unconstitutional agencies need to go away. But here's how I would have handled if I were ahead of the Republicans. I would say, we have an unsolvable debt problem here that is, we're not going to default because we refuse to extend the debt limit. We're going to default if we let the debt limit go higher. That's what guarantees default. The only thing to stop default is to stop deficit spending right now. And so if I were a leader of Congress, I'd say, what we're going to do, we're never going to raise the debt ceiling again, ever. So get used to it. We are going to hold the line. As of today, we have a balanced budget amendment. You cannot spend more than what you have. And it doesn't take two-thirds to pass it. We have the law of the books right now on the debt ceiling limit, and it only takes 51% to maintain it. You see what a gem they had in their fist, and Boehner gave it away without any concessions, and literally poisoned the waters so that nobody wants to go through it again. They've lost all power to stop this debt ceiling from eventually going to default.
But I don't see them ever, you know, passing that type of legislation because when you've got almost 50% now, I think it's almost on the brink of 50% of Americans who are receiving some sort of government subsidy. What is it now? 1 in 6 Americans are on green stamps, food stamps.
43 million on food stamps, and 100 million people, and there's a lot of overlap, though. 100 million people have some type of benefit from government, whether it's, you know, subsidized loans or subsidized this and that. But it's still not a majority, but there's a majority of voters have sympathy with these types of benefits because they don't have to pay for it.
Exactly.
They're being paid for with deficit spending. It's the politician's dream is to be able to deficit spend, and the Republicans had in their hand, still have in their hand, the power to say, no more, we're simply not going to pass it.
But when this perception... Go ahead, Joel.
But they need to be clear and say, now we are authorizing enough government and we're authorizing money for these programs. And if he doesn't do it, look to the president. Don't ever come back to us and say, open the government. We've given enough money for him to open the essential parts of government. Look to the president. He's the one. And we'll impeach him. That's what they should say. But, of course, both political parties, including the Republicans, are controlled by this powerful secret combination of power that controls our government, and that's why we don't get change. We have wolves in sheep clothing, like John Boehner, standing up there pretending to be a conservative, and he was intending to sabotage this thing at all. And like in lockstep, the media is now saying, no more, we can never do this again. Jack Lew, Treasury Secretary, we can never allow this to happen again. The New York Times, we can never let this happen again. Do you see how they've set us up? So the Republicans won't dare shut down the government again.
Joel Skousen, editor and publisher of World Affairs Brief. We'll take a quick time out, come back. Can you hang in for another segment, Joel?
Yes, I can.
Terrific, because I do want to talk, if time permits, I want to talk about something you mentioned in your last brief, and that was this horrible situation that occurred on Capitol Hill last month, this emotionally distraught woman, yes. a mother of a small child, shot by Washington police, and we'll talk about some of the troubling, lingering questions that remain surrounding that fatal shooting. Back with more of my conversation with Joel Skousen. Stay with us. I'll be at the Zoomer show October 27th, Sunday, October 27th, from 2 to 5 p.m. So come on down and say hello. Explore hundreds of ways to live big: travel, money, health, fitness, retirement, reinvention. If it's new, it can show you how to live big. It's at the Zoomer show. And again, I'll be there Sunday, 2 to 5 p.m., October 27th, zoomershow.com for information. Joel Skousen, editor-publisher of World Affairs Brief, stays with us as we poke around backstage in the Global Theater. Earlier this month, of course, this horrible tragedy, an emotionally distraught woman suffering from postpartum depression, it would appear, tried to crash through the gates at the White House and was eventually shot and killed by police while her one-year-old baby daughter was in the car. And I believe she was just buried the other day. Family finally laid her to rest. I'm not sure what the status of the child is. I believe she was placed with Children's Aid at one point, although, yeah. You know, certainly, you know, a support system there. The mother, I believe, came from a pretty good family, and she has, you know, her parents and others are willing to take the child. Joel, what is the latest on this horrible story?
Well, you know, you can understand, initially at least, why police would be concerned about a car. Basically, she didn't get to the actual gates of the White House. She got to the foregate where they check credentials, etc., and ran through that, and you know, some agents immediately swarmed out there, had barricades in their hand to kind of block the car, and then she zipped around and got away from them, and there was a chase that ensued. Her name was Miriam Carey, and the problem, you know, you can understand, though, that, you know, when you have a car that could be loaded with explosives, that's why they have a foregate before the actual gate. You've really got to stop these cars because of the fact we've had, you know, suicide bombers, you know, go into the Marine barracks in trucks loaded with explosives. So this is a very dangerous thing. So I can understand the response with highly armed SWAT teams, et cetera. But what really happened was the fact that, well, first of all, the media stated that the woman was shot when she got out of the car. Later, the police found that there was a small child in the car, and they took him to protectors. But this isn't what happened at all. In Wolf Blitzer's situation room on CNN, he's interviewing a very credible professional woman witness right across the street who saw the whole thing happen, and she clearly states that she saw the police stop the car, open the door, pull out the child and rush to safety, and then the mother came out of the car and they just let loose and blasted her. Her face was not even recognizable from all the bullets that they pumped into her body. It was just a volley of automatic weapon fire from many different, and it was just absolutely unnecessary. And what's problematic, Richard, about this is the virtual silence of the media. There's no uproar. I mean, this was on CNN. This was Wolf Blitzer, who's supposed, and he's done no follow-up from this. The press has asked no questions. It's just disappeared. This should be a major scandal.
So what's going on, Joel? What is happening here?
Well, what this does indicate to me is that, first of all, and I frankly can't understand why they would do that. I mean, clearly when a woman gets out, it'd be different if she had a big overcoat that looked like she had an explosive vest on it. But she's dressed in a normal, you know, tank top that's tight to the body. There's no explosives there. There's no reason to pull the trigger. She's got her hands up. You know, why do you blast this woman? So somebody either trigger-happy starts in and everybody else starts. You know, these are a SWAT team mentality. This is a military mentality here. Everybody opens fire. There's no leadership there controlling this situation. And all of a sudden, there's a cover-up. And this tells you something. When the media, in lockstep, is completely silent about this killing and the unexplainable, and, you know, there's a cover-up. Somebody's called all the media and said, don't ever talk about this again. And everybody's in lockstep with it.
Well,
I mean, this is what's happening.
Joel, you've probably seen these rumors floating around in certain online publications, trying to connect this child, this one-year-old baby, to President Obama. And apparently, Obama was in Connecticut addressing, I'm not sure if it was a graduating class, and had supposedly, the story goes, had some emergency dental work done in the very office where this woman was working as a dental hygienist. And these are the rumors, and you know, I'm not giving them any, you know, credibility here. I'm just saying that this is what's floating out there, and I'm wondering if you've heard these and what your thoughts are.
Well, I don't have any way of corroborating those rumors, and that's the problem with a lot of these things that come out of the alternative media. Even if, you know, I assume they're assuming that this was a child by Obama or somehow.
This is a love child, and you know, to cover it up, the mother was targeted for assassination. I'm just reporting on what's being floating out there.
The problem with that is that you would have to have recognizable information that this was the woman. That it might well be why she's showing up at the White House. I mean, that's a very good reason. You know, she has tried to get in touch with the president or not, but you know, she would have to be recognized and. And then someone would have had a telephone in, this woman has to be eliminated. It's possible. I mean, one of the problems that I have, though, is that, you know, Obama is, you know, a noted homosexual. I'm just not sure, you know, how dedicated he would be to try to, you know, father or at least deal with women in that regard. So I don't think we're ever going to know, but this is certainly plausible. They do these kinds of things all the time to protect the president. Look at Vince Foster. I don't think Clinton gave the order to kill Vince Foster. He was a good friend of his. He set up his secret Swiss bank accounts. He knew too much. He was getting cold feet. He might have talked to Congress. I think his Clinton handlers said, we're getting rid of Foster.
All right, got to take a time out. If I could just beg your indulgence and keep you for a little bit longer, Joel, on the other side.
All right.
Appreciate it. Joel Skousen, World Affairs Brief, back with more in a moment. All right, just a couple more minutes with Joel Skousen. I wanted to keep you on, Joel, just because I had someone called in and wanted to speak to you. And let's get to Kyla in Toronto. Kyla, welcome.
Hi, Richard. Hi, Joel. This is the first time I've ever heard about that chemical warfare on the Syria residents being mentioned that it was falsified. That's never in mainstream media. Do you think it ever will be? And how come I never seem to hear anything about Syria mainstream news anymore? It's like they just don't seem to talk about Syria anymore in mainstream news. It's like, how come?
Well, Kyla,
I'll line up and listen to the response.
Oh, I appreciate it. Yeah, we've sort of addressed, you know, why we're not hearing about it, because, you know, Syria is complying with this order to decommission its chemical weapons. But as to, you know, why we haven't heard that the allegations that the Syrian forces were responsible for the chemical attack haven't been proven. Joel, I'll let you handle that one.
Well, the Russians have satellite imagery about the trajectory of the so-called rocket. There was actually more than one chemical shipped in to the rebels. We have documentation through a British filmmaker, interviewer of Syrian rebels talking about receiving chemical weapons from the Saudi Arabians. That never made the mainstream press in the West. Neither did the Russian evidence. These rockets came from areas that the U.S. says were under control of the Syrian army, and the Syrian army says, no, we don't have absolute control of those areas. There are also rebels in that area, and they could have launched the rocket as well. The point is, the U.S. has never made their case, and the Saud said this in interviews. He said, show me the evidence, because the Germans, Der Spiegel, came out claiming we have all the proof. And he said, show me the proof. The U.S. hasn't shown me the proof. They haven't shown the world any proof. And Der Spiegel didn't have the proof. They just said, well, the U.S. claims they have it. Well, show it to me. They don't have proof. A lot of supposition.
We also had a U.N. report back in May confirming that these insurgents had used chemical agents in, was it Aleppo in May?
That's right. There have been two other incidents where the UN came to the conclusion that these were done by the rebels. And so, you know, there is, but what happened, several weeks ago when the U.S. made this decision, you know, we know that the Syrian government did this. You know, this is not disputable. We know. And every time they open and says, since Assad has attacked his own people, since Assad has done this, and this is just a campaign of statements, of positive statements, indicative that are absolutely false and that are unprovable. And, you know, I've asked the question in the world, why would Assad, knowing that the U.S. is just looking for an excuse to attack, hand it to them by authorizing, and for what military advantage? In the middle of a bunch of civilians to launch a minor chemical rocket? I mean, what would that even prove versus bullets, versus mortar shells? Nothing at all. No military tactician would use chemical weapons in those things. Only on battlefields where you have a mass of enemy troops without any civilians around and you use gas to incapacitate it. That's when you use it. You don't use it in guerrilla warfare. Nobody buys into that.
Joel, once again, how do we subscribe to World Affairs Brief?
Well, people can go to worldaffairsbrief.com and click on the subscribe button. They should get a free sample copy first, though, to see what I do provide each week, Friday when my analysis comes out. They can get that free sample copy by emailing me at editor@worldaffairsbrief.com.
Joel, always a pleasure. Thank you for this. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Richard. Goodbye.
Joel Skousen, World Affairs Brief. All right. I mentioned at the top of the program, as I made my way into the studio, before I was accosted by a four-legged growling creature. If you missed that, yeah, there was a dog wandering around in here and belonged to someone in the building, got out of a studio, I guess, where he was working, and walking down to the studio, and all of a sudden I hear this growling behind me. I turn around, and there's this dog. Anyway, but before that, I dropped into the mailroom, and I just wanted to take a few moments to share some letters and things. First of all, I've been away for a couple of weeks. Of course, last week was Thanksgiving. Victor Vigiani, thank you once again for filling in. Great interview with Linda Moulton Howe, also a great program Victor did on GMOs. Now, the mail piles up, and got this letter. I wanted to share this with you. I'm not going to mention any names or numbers. This is Richard. My name is blank. Call me. Gives the phone number. This is a cell phone, but it's a pay-as-you-go monthly Fido card, so unfortunately I can't talk long on it. If you can call from a landline, then I can call you back from a landline. Less chance of being recorded or overheard. I have a story that is bigger than Edward Snowden's exposé. In fact, it's the biggest story of all time up to now. Snowden reported or exposed only a symptom of the real evil, and I'm a little surprised no one but a few realize what's going on and about to happen. This involves all 7 billion citizens of Earth. Also, I'm not looking for notoriety in any way. I'll bet Snowden wishes he had done his story in a more subversive, anonymous fashion. It's that serious, although many won't believe it, but it can be nothing else at this date in history. All right, so rest assured, dear letter writer, I will be calling you back on a secure line. Then I received this. To whom it may concern, Mr. Serrett. Hello, sir. My name is blank, and I recently read an article off the internet about your show about extremely low frequency, or ELF. And I believe I'm a victim. After doing some research, I discovered information that relates to myself, such as groin shocks, involuntary muscle movements, such as my back, feet, arms, legs, thighs, and my buttocks. I also hear voices through my ceilings and walls. It's like someone is controlling my mind. I believe all electronics buzz my ear, such as radios at home, my television. If I walk by a stop sign, sometimes it actually will send a buzz through my ears. It's like I've been programmed just for the negative. My television has a constant ring, but if I turn it off, it stops. When I want to say something in my mind, I feel like it doesn't want to say what I'm thinking of. It erases it and goes back to what it's programmed to do. I even saw red lasers flash through vehicles I've been riding in. If not bad enough, I have a constant buzz in my ear all day. It even goes to the point where I believe my dreams are being controlled. I have even found homemade devices around my house, even looked into my TV box outside where we were sick. Sorry, it's a little difficult to read this writing. Homemade devices around my house, even looked into my TV box outside. We have six people in the house. No one put it there. It looked like some homemade antenna. Even more crazy, I used to take a certain route to the store, and I discovered homemade antennas placed by magnets on a couple light poles. They were never there, then all of a sudden appeared. My route was where I was walking, but no other street lights have... Anyway, it goes on and on for several... This person claiming to be a victim of electronic harassment, and season one and two of The Conspiracy Show are in repeats on Vision TV across the country, and I don't get a chance to watch it as much, you know, so I always know, though, what episode is airing when the letters start coming and the emails, and someone will reference one of the episodes, and then I say, ah, that must have been on TV last night. So, obviously, recently, the electronic harassment episode has aired, and I've been receiving, it must be a dozen emails now in the last week and a half or two, including one from an emergency room doctor, also claiming to be a victim of electronic harassment. And obviously one has to be mindful that people, you know, can be delusional, can be mentally ill and so forth. But I sincerely believe that there is something going on. When you hear from this many people on a constant basis, and I've met these people and spoken to them and met with them in their homes and talked to them face to face. And no, I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm not a psychologist. I'm not able to, you know, diagnose mental illnesses. But all I can say is, as a human being and looking into their eyes and listening to them, I believe that they are sincere and genuine and not mentally ill. Something is going on. We'll have to do another show on that soon. Anyway, I will be in contact with these individuals. I also wanted to – this just arrived in the mail as well. A new book by our good friend Nick Redfern, For Nobody's Eyes Only, Missing Government Files and Hidden Archives That Document the Truth Behind the Most Enduring Conspiracy Theories. Nick, if you don't know, is a very fine writer. He's a British citizen who now resides in Texas and covers the UFO beat and much, much more. And this is his latest, For Nobody's Eyes Only. So we've put the call into Nick to get him on the show, but the book has arrived. And then, haven't heard from Frank Joseph in a while, sort of a real-life Indiana Jones explorer, writes about ancient America, pre-Columbus. And his new book is The Lost Colonies of Ancient America, A Comprehensive Guide to the Pre-Columbian Visitors That Really Discovered America. One of my favorite quotes from Frank Joseph when talking about the history of pre-Columbian America is, he says, Columbus wasn't first, he was last. So we'll put the call into Frank Joseph as well, try to get him up, get him on the program. Coming up shortly in the coming weeks, we'll get back into our JFK series with James DiEugenio. He'll be here the first week of November, the first and second week of November, as we continue along commemorating the 50th anniversary of JFK. And we'll go full bore in the month of November, of course, the 22nd being the 50th anniversary. So James DiEugenio, the first and second week of November. And then I believe it's the third week of November, We'll bring in Jim Mars, Nelson Thal, and James Fetzer, three top Kennedy assassination researchers, in the first hour of the program. Jim Mars, of course, the author of Crossfire. That was the book that sort of served as the blueprint for Oliver Stone's movie JFK, and Jim Mars was a consultant on the film. And very quickly, a great memory that I have, my first time in Dallas, in Daly Plaza, and I had arranged earlier, or later in the day rather, to meet with Jim at his home in just outside Dallas for the TV show, to interview him for the TV show. I had my cell phone with me, and I'm walking just past the Texas Book Depository building, and the phone rings, and it's Jim Mars. And I said, oh, Jim, what a coincidence. Yes, I'm confirmed. I'll be at your place at 4 o'clock. I'm just in Dealey Plaza right now. And then over the phone, Jim gives me this wonderful guided tour of Dealey Plaza. He says, okay, stop where you are right now. Look over your shoulder. Do you see the window on the sixth floor? Look at the tree in front of it. That tree was exactly the same height in 1963. There's no way Oswald could have shot. Anyway, he went on and on and on, and I'm walking along. He's pointing over the phone all these amazing facts about Dealey Plaza. If you're going to get a guided tour of Dealey Plaza, you know, Jim Mars is the guy to give it. Anyway, listen, the website, richardserrett.com, as always, is your portal to The Conspiracy Show. I've posted some interesting stories up there, including, well, for those of you who are techies, you may be surprised or disheartened to learn that your D-Link router on your internet, your D-Link router is what provides, you know, the wireless internet. Is that right, Tim? Your D-Link router may have a backdoor. NSA-inspired paranoia within the hacker community about the pervasiveness of the government's power to compromise equipment may be bearing real fruit. A curious computer security professional published findings on Saturday that deconstructed the firmware code for some D-Link router services and discovered a backdoor built directly into the code. By changing the user agent in a web browser, then they go on to give you the user agent name, a user could bypass the security on the device and get online or control the higher functions of the router. 410-meter asteroid may collide with planet Earth in 2032. Those are just a couple of the stories I've posted at richardserrett.com. Say hello on Twitter, at Richard Serrett. And as always, follow the truth. Hey, welcome aboard. Great to have you with us. Hope you're with us for the duration. Once again, we would like to welcome our new affiliate. This is number 25, WESB News Radio, 1490 in Bradford, Pennsylvania. And that is in northern Pennsylvania. Beautiful state. I love Pennsylvania. Driving through, I guess it's the Allegheny Mountains. And there's a particular county down there that I've traveled to a few times that I've just fallen in love with. It's called Bucks County. And there are all these beautiful stone houses that date back to the war, you know, the Revolutionary War. We're talking, you know, 250-year-old houses or 230-year-old houses. Anyway, beautiful country in Pennsylvania. Just one of those places you just love to drive. Get in the car and just drive. And with no particular place to go. As Chuck Desing. So WESB News Radio 1490, Bradford, Pennsylvania. Welcome and glad to be part of your radio station. Had the boys out. Well, I didn't. The Mighty Aphrodite took the boys out pumpkin hunting on the weekend. And they brought back six of them. Five small ones and one fairly large one. And for $20. Anyway, they're very excited. They're going to be, you know, carving and painting and having some friends over next weekend and sort of a belated birthday party. They're going to incorporate the carving of the jack-o'-lantern into the proceedings with their friends. Although North is a little distraught because hasn't been performing well in school lately, and after sort of laying down the law, that continued for several weeks, and so unfortunately, we had to take away his trick-or-treating evening, so he won't be going out Halloween, but he gets to dress up and shell out candy, and we'll make it fun for him. But, you know, you got to do it. Sometimes you got to lay down the law as a parent, and I feel bad for the little guy because he's been lobbying me behind the scenes. He says, "Do you think Mom will let me go out if I do better in school?" I said, "North, just, you know, you can give it a shot, but unfortunately, I think the die is cast. He'll get over it, I hope. I hope." Halloween, of course, is top of mind for everyone, especially the little ones, as we head on into the latter half of October. And, you know, we don't just talk about ghosts this time of year. We talk about ghosts all year long on The Conspiracy Show. But it is, you know, top of mind at this time of year. And recently became aware of a woman who author of 10 books, and they call her the real-life ghost whisperer. And delighted to have her on the program tonight to talk about not only about everything you want to know about ghosts, but also about people who are susceptible to entity possession or oppression, and also about this whole phenomenon around earthbound souls. There are multiple reasons, and she's delved into this and researched it, as to why a departed spirit becomes earthbound. And I thought we could go there for the next hour. Dr. Susan Chomsky, as I say, the author of 10 books, including The Power of Auras, The Power of Chakras, Instant Healing, Exploring Meditation, How to Hear the Voice of God, Miracle Prayer, and Divine Revelation. She is, as I say, an expert in depossession and in clearing noxious zones and geopathic lines from the environment. She also relates anecdotes about entity possession and oppression. Dr. Susan Chomsky, welcome to The Conspiracy Show. How are you?
Wonderful. I'm so happy to be here. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you just fine. Thank you. Thank
you. Wonderful.
So where did this all begin for you in investigating ghosts? I mean, were you a are you a medium? Are you a psychic?
I would not call myself a medium or a psychic. I'm actually a spiritual teacher. And where I first became interested in astral possession was when I got possessed myself as a teenager. And I had to overcome that through meditation. It was a terrifying experience that took place in my life at age 18 in 1966, when I was a hippie in the San Francisco Bay Area. And at that time, we were all delving into spiritual experiences. Really, our gurus at that time were Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert, who were extolling the virtues of LSD. And Richard Alpert later became Ram Dass, as I'm sure you're aware
right,
of.
Right.
And at that time, we wanted to explore spirituality. We wanted to have spiritual experiences. We wanted to open to spiritual enlightenment. But when I had my first LSD trip, I didn't have, I had some experiences of mind expansion. But I also became possessed by an entity. And it was a horrifying, terrifying experience. And it did not go away because I didn't know how to heal it or what to do with it. And neither did anybody else as they witnessed it happening.
Well, what was this entity? What was this entity? Tell me about it, Susan.
See, what happened was I was on an LSD trip. And then I went back to the apartment of one of the people. We were taking acid. And all of a sudden, I started to say out loud, "I don't know how to die. I don't know how to die." And I was repeating it over and over. But then I started to say it at an ear-splitting voice. I was screaming it. And I was also stomping my feet at the same time. This is what they tell me. I remember saying the words, "I don't know how to die," but I do not remember the horrific display that went on. They told me about it the next morning. And obviously, it was an earthbound spirit who had taken possession of my body, yelling, "I don't know how to die," and using my body. And stomping with my feet.
Well, Susan, let me just jump in here if I could. I mean, you say obviously, but how does one differentiate between just a bad trip, as they used to say back in the 60s, a bad trip and a possession?
Okay. Well, this was not just a bad trip. This was definitely a possession because I was this spirit was using my body, stomping my feet, yelling, "I don't know how to die." I mean, it's definitely a spirit that was doing that through me. And after that, I never really came down from that acid trip. It was horrific. And I had terrible experiences for quite a long time after that. However, the drugs, the psychedelic drugs, did open me up to altered states that gave me a very strong desire to experience true meditation. And I was reading books like Paramahansa Yogananda's Autobiography of a Yogi. I was reading Alan Watts' The Way of Zen. I was reading the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and really we all were. We were reading these kinds of books at that time. I'm sure people don't realize that the flower children of that time were seeking spiritual awakening and spiritual enlightenment. And when I read Alan Watt's book, it said that you need to find a meditation guide. Well, in 1966, in Berkeley, California, you didn't go to the yellow pages to find meditation guide or yoga or anything remotely similar to that. So I asked a roommate, well, you know, I need to find a meditation guide. How can I do that? And he said, well, have you ever tried to meditate yourself? So I said, well, yeah, okay, I'll give that a shot. I don't know, but I'll try. So I lay down on my bed. I didn't know what to do. I lay down on my bed, and I kind of prayed for or asked for a meditation. Immediately, I was propelled into an ecstatic state. There was a cord or rush of energy that was rushing from the tips of my toes all the way to the top of my head. I felt like I was being plugged into an electric socket. And this rush of energy went through my body. And it was very ecstatic. And I thought, well, I guess this is meditation. You know, I didn't know any better. Little did I know that I had my first meditation experience along with my first complete Kundalini awakening at the same time.
Wow. I mean, people work on that meditation for decades and some never achieve it. And you just lie back on the bed and it happened.
Well, the thing is, I do believe that people work on these things for lifetimes. This doesn't just happen in 5 minutes. I have past life recall of being a sannyasi in India, of being a renunciate, of being on the Ganges River, and of meditating in caves and so on. So, you know, we've been doing this for a long time. Anyone who is sensitive to spiritual experiences, anyone who has any kind of clairvoyance, clairaudience, clairsentience, anyone who is somewhat psychic or somewhat sensitive or somewhat intuitive or has had interesting spiritual experiences, we've been doing this for a long time, many lifetimes.
Let me get back to the, we're just coming up on a break here, but let's start, get back into this conversation regarding your possession by this entity that entered your body during an LSD trip back in the late or mid to late 60s in San Francisco. What happened after that initial, you know, possession? Did this entity make itself known to you by name? Did it appear to you? How did it manifest itself?
No, it did not. That just took place that one night. But after that, I really never came down from the LSD trip. My senses were permanently opened. The LSD, what it did is, it's as if the volume on all of my senses was turned up to the max. Colors were brighter. I was incredibly sensitive to everything in my environment. I was hearing, I don't know if they were hallucinations or if they were real. I was hearing other people's thoughts. It was a very strange experience, and it was actually terrifying at the time because it was a complete, and also I was out of my body. I was like a foot above my body. So all of that was taking place. That actual possession itself was that, specifically that one night. But I am sure there were entities that were around me because I was having these voices. There were certain voices that were coming to me that were laughing at me and jeering at me and making fun of me. And it was like a paranoid hallucination. But I do believe that these were real voices of astral entities, earthbound spirits or whatever they were, or demonic beings even, that were around me and that were trying to possess me.
All right. Dr. Susan Shumsky stays with us. We'll come back on the other side, continue to discuss possessions or oppression and Earthbound Souls. We'll also open up the phone lines. Questions or comments, most welcome. The Conspiracy Show back with more right after this. Dr. Susan Shumsky is with us. Her latest book is The Power of Auras. We're talking about ghosts tonight and Earthbound Souls and possession. Susan was possessed back in the late 60s while on an LSD trip. I'm wondering, though, in terms of meditation, and I've heard from some who sort of have cautioned that when one is in deep meditation, you are opening yourself up to potential possession. Was that ever a concern?
No, actually, meditation for me cured me of all possession. However, if a person is a psychic sponge, a psychic sponge is a person who absorbs the energies around them as a sponge absorbs water. And if they are a psychic sponge and they do not keep their auras closed off, then they might be susceptible to entity oppression or possession. There are many reasons why a person is susceptible to entity possession or oppression. But if the meditation practice is worth its salt, there's no reason that a person would become possessed through meditation unless they're just sitting there going into a kind of a blank state and just kind of like daydreaming, going off into Nowheresville. Yes, that, but I don't call that meditation. I call that daydreaming.
All right. What through your meditation, Susan, what did you learn regarding, I guess, the entities that inhabit what I guess you would call the astral plane? Where is the astral plane? What does it look like? And what inhabits the astral plane? Or who inhabits the astral plane?
That's a great question, Richard. The astral plane is another dimension. We're in the physical plane right now. But there are four basic planes of existence. There is the spiritual plane, the mental plane, the astral plane, and the environmental plane. And the environmental plane meaning this physical world. So in the astral world, which is another dimension, it is parallel to this dimension, it's at the same time, in the same space, but in another dimension. There are beings who inhabit the astral world. They might be earthbound spirits who did not go into the divine light after death, who got stuck or stranded in this gray area. I can only kind of describe it as a gray, flat, grayish area. And there are also other kinds of beings who dwell in the astral world, such as demonic kind of beings who've never taken human form. Also what I call rakshasas, that's the Sanskrit word for a type of being that is really a thought form that has taken shape and sort of has a life of its own. It's kind of a flat cardboard cutout figure. And mainly it is souls who did not go into the light. They're kind of stuck in this place. Some people call it limbo. It is an astral world.
Doesn't sound like a place I'd like to visit.
I don't think so. I don't think anyone should open themselves up to it or want to visit it. But there are many people who open themselves up consciously to it all the time.
How easy or difficult is it for entities on the astral plane or in the astral plane to come on over into our reality?
Well, they don't really come on over into our reality, but if they use a lot of willpower, they can move objects. For example, poltergeist. A poltergeist, literally that word means a mischievous spirit. And what that would be is a ghost who is rattling the windows and rattling the doors and turning the TVs on and off and that sort of thing. So, yes, through their willpower, they can manage to move objects in the physical world. But they're still in the astral world. They haven't really become physical.
Now, you write about the various reasons that people who die, rather than go into the divine light, as you call it, they become earthbound, earthbound souls. And one of them you mention is disunion from organ donations. This is fascinating. Tell me more about that.
Well, it can happen that a living human being will go to the DMV and sign up on their donor card, and they say, oh, yeah, sure, take my organs when I die. Okay. So that's good and well if the human being has not identified 100% with their body as being all that they are. There are some people who do not really believe in a spiritual plane, or they think that there's just the body, and when the body's dead, nothing happens after that. The body just dies. There's no soul that lives on. There's no mind that lives on. Just the body dies, and that's it. Yes, everything's blank.
You're talking about materialists.
That's the end.
Materialists.
A complete materialist, Richard, will think that way. They will think that this is all there is. This material world is all there is. Then, after death, they notice that their organs are being carved out of the body because they're conscious of this taking place, because they're still stuck in the body because they think that the body's all there is. They haven't moved on. So it's a bit disconcerting to have their organs being carved out of their
body. I would say.
Because of that, they get stuck. They're stranded in the astral world. So this is just one reason why a person might not move on into the light.
And how did you find this out?
It was something that actually just was revealed to me through divine revelation, which is, you know, something I do, something I teach. And also, all these 14 reasons came to me as a result of my experiences of just knowing about ghosts and spirits and what happens to them after death, really.
Are you able to communicate with the denizens of the astral plane?
I could. I don't really want to.
Do they ever?
No, I don't communicate with them. I just send them into the light.
Do they present themselves to you and say, I need help?
Sometimes they do. And sometimes I call upon the ones that are in the immediate environment that need healing. And then they will come for healing. They'll come for help. And then just send them into the light. Anyone can do this, you know. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to send ghosts into the light.
Oh, well, what do you do then? I mean, what do you say?
You just speak lovingly to the entity. You just speak lovingly to that one who needs healing. And you just speak to them directly. And you just say you are filled and surrounded with God's love. You are filled and surrounded with God's light. And you just speak lovingly like that to the entity. And then you tell them that they're free. They're free from fear. They're free from pain. You tell them that they are lifted into the light, into the divine light. And you tell them that they're blessed. They're forgiven. They're released into the love, light, and wholeness of divinity. And you just speak like that, and you can also call upon a divine being to take them into the divine light.
So in each case, these earthbound souls, what is it? They don't know that they've passed on? They need someone to point out, listen, you're dead. Turn around, see the light, walk towards it. Is it like that?
Yes, some of them don't know they're dead. There was a movie about that, The Sixth Sense,
yes,
with Bruce Willis, who played a character who just didn't even know he was dead. Because after death, nothing changes. You still have your senses. You still have your mind. And if you don't realize that you're no longer in that body, you'll just be walking around thinking that you're still alive. This can happen quite often with a sudden or accidental death. In The Sixth Sense, it was portrayed as being somebody that got suddenly killed. You know, it was unexpected. This would rarely happen with somebody who's ill, dying in bed. They would, that just wouldn't happen to them because they know they're going to die. And then they die and they're aware that they're dead. But if it's a sudden accidental death, this is the reason why you have so many ghosts hanging around battlefields. Because they don't realize that, you know, they get shot suddenly and they're dead. And so if a person doesn't know they're dead, you can help them, you know. Like, for example, my mother didn't know she was dead. She was in the mortuary. I'm sitting there next to her, and I'm hearing her. She's talking to me, okay, because I have clairaudience. I can hear beings talk to me. So my mother was telling me, let me go, let me go, let me go, let me go. And I'm sitting there, and she's continuing to repeat this over and over and over. And then it dawned on me, this was the same thing she was saying to me in the hospital. And then I just realized, and also I noticed that her vibration was very encased. It was in the body. It was not, if you, usually when you're around a deceased person, their energy field is very expanded, as if it's infinite. It becomes very big. And hers was very encased, right there still in the body.
You mean you sense that, or you see it? You see this energy field?
It's something that I feel more than see. It's more of the feeling than the vision for me. Some people can see more. I can feel more in that case. So I walked over to her and I said, hey, Mom, you're dead. You know, I had to explain to her that she was dead so that she would be able to move on. And it was a very touching experience because I told her she was free. And then after that happened, she actually became more expanded and she realized that she could see things. She had had macular degeneration, so she was basically blind before she passed over. Suddenly she could see, she could walk, which she couldn't do with any facility before she was dead. She could even dance. So she felt very free once I explained it to her.
What are some of the other reasons that people become earthbound after death?
Okay, some of the other reasons why they become earthbound, they might just be kind of lost and confused and wandering around in a dazed state. And that can happen if the person before they died had, for example, Alzheimer's disease, or if they were senile, or if they had really heavy drug, if they were drugged very heavily right before death. You know, for example, in the hospices, they drug the people very, very heavily, and they just come totally out of it. So then they're just kind of lost and dazed and confused after death for a while because of that. And there's many other reasons, too. For example, the person doesn't even believe in God, or they don't believe in a light, or they don't believe in an afterlife. And because of that, they just don't think anything exists after death. And because of that, their soul is prevented from seeing the light. They just don't see the light, and they don't enter the light.
This clairaudience that you have, I mean, is it... is it difficult for you? I mean, are there, like in the television show Medium, are there ghosts vying to get your attention?
No, because I know how to keep my aura closed off. I don't open my sensitivity all the time. I don't allow myself to be a psychic sponge. So I keep my aura closed off. And I keep my aura open, closed off to the lower astral world and open to the spiritual realm. In other words, I open up to the spiritual dimension and not to the astral dimension. And because of that, no, I don't get bothered by ghosts trying to get my attention or anything like that because I don't allow it.
But if you're called, do you go out to places to do an investigation and to help these entities if they require assistance?
Certainly, I will help anyone who needs help. Mostly, it's people who need help because they have oppressions or possessions. That's what I'm dealing with more than investigations of houses or something like that. Although there has been cases in which there was poltergeist activity. I didn't go to the places, but I was told about the houses. For example, there was one that was just horrific kinds of experiences were going on, including the clothing in the closets being torn to shreds. And I just crazy stuff was going on in this people's in this one person's house, for example.
Well, listen, we'll take it. Sorry, Susan, I'll jump in here. We'll take a time out. We'll come back and maybe we can discuss that house in a little more detail and continue to delve into possessions, oppressions, earthbound souls with the ghost whisperer, Dr. Susan Shumsky, her latest book, The Power of Auras. Stay with us. Ghost whisperer Dr. Susan Shumsky is with us. Her latest book is The Power of Auras. We're talking about earthbound souls. Back to this this house that was undergoing all of this poltergeist activity. What else can you tell me? You went out to investigate this place?
No, as I said, I don't really go out to places. They just they talk to me on the phone, tell me about these problems and so on. And I do the healings remotely. And also, I teach people how to heal themselves mainly. Because the reality is that if a person is a psychic sponge, if a person is unconsciously inviting this kind of possession and oppression into their energy fields, they need to heal themselves. So what I do is I give people prescriptions of what to do to heal themselves. In this case, it was both the girl and her mom, that the girl is the one who really, really worked on herself to overcome this horrific poltergeist and possession that was taking place in their house and around their house. And she did. She healed herself. And the next time I actually saw her personally, she came on one of our conferences that we have on cruise ships, and she told me that, you know, it's virtually gone away. And she is really on a strong healing path now. So what I try to do, you know, instead of fishing for people, is teach them how to fish. I teach people how to heal themselves.
Well, we'll address that before we finish up here. But I'm curious, what or who is doing the possessing? Is it a departed spirit, or is it some demonic entity, or what?
It's very rare for it to be a demonic being. That would be pretty rare. Mostly it's earthbound spirits, mischievous or malevolent. Now, a lot of possessions are due to souls who had addictions to drugs, alcohol, sex, food, whatever their addiction of choice. When the body dies, there's no body anymore. You cannot continue your addiction in a dead body. So that wandering, tormented soul wanders around trying to attach itself to a living human in order to continue their addiction through them. So who would be susceptible to something like that? Well, obviously another addict, somebody who's already into alcohol or drugs or sex or whatever it is. But sometimes the soul is so desperate, they'll just latch on to the first weakened human they see, maybe somebody that's just had an accident or something like that. And because of that, that living human will have a sudden personality change. They'll suddenly get into drugs. They'll suddenly have an addiction. There's an interesting book about this sort of thing written by Edith Fiore, and I believe it's called Hungry. Now suddenly the title eludes me, but her name is Edith Fiore, and it's about hungry ghosts. And
So is that one of the symptoms then? If you notice, for example, a loved one or maybe even yourself, this wholesale personality change, Maybe all of a sudden you take up smoking or drinking where you hadn't before. Is that one of the telltale signs of a possession?
I would say so, absolutely. And in that case, it's, you know, psychiatrists, psychologists, they have no clue what's going on. They don't know how to heal this stuff. They just don't know.
What are some of the other symptoms that one might be possessed?
Well, depression, lackadaisical attitude, you know, just nightmares, having a tremendous energy drained, feeling drained all the time, no reason, just weakness, a lot of weakness. And there can also be physical symptoms. There can be all kinds of pains, and pains that seemingly psychosomatic. You go to the doctor and there's no reason for them. Because a lot of people who get possessed or oppressed, they will get these like nauseating feelings or odd pains here and there.
That sounds like a lot of people I know, Susan.
No, well,
I'm not joking. I mean, it's just, you see it everywhere. And a lot of people languishing in despair and depression and fatigue. And here we just thought it was, you know, modern day living beating us down. And perhaps it's some malevolent departed soul from the astral plane glomming onto us. Let's delve into this further when we come back. Ghost Whisperer, Dr. Susan Shumsky, right here on The Conspiracy Show. Stay with us. Dr. Susan Shumsky stays with us, Ghost Whisperer, and her new book is The Power of Auras. Tell me a little bit more about the connection between auras. You mentioned, you know, closing off your aura in order to prevent entities from entering. What's the connection between auras and the spirit world?
Right. The thing is, we have an aura, which is layers of energy around the physical body, around and permeating. It isn't just around, it's permeating the physical body and around it. And these various layers of our energy field, if we open our aura, we are susceptible to psychic attack. We're susceptible to energy vampirism. By the way, some of your depressed and low energy people is due to psychic vampirism, not necessarily entities from the astral world. We're also susceptible, if we leave our auras open, we're susceptible to entities from the astral world. So that's why it's really important for us to say some affirmations or visualize keeping our aura closed off to the lower astral realm and open to the spiritual world.
Well, most people are not conscious of their auras. They may not even know they have auras. So how do you learn to open and close them?
It's really very simple. Just use a simple affirmation. I'll tell you what it is right now, if you like.
Please,
Richard, would you
please,
like that?
Absolutely.
Okay, so the affirmation goes like this. I am in control. I am one with God. I am the only authority in my life. I am divinely protected by the light of my being. I close off my aura and body of light to the lower astral levels of mind, and I open to the spiritual world. Thank you, God, and so it is.
And how did that come to you?
I actually studied with specific teacher. I was in the Transcendental Meditation Organization for 22 years. After that, I studied with a gentleman named Dr. Peter Meyer from San Diego. And he had founded a couple different teachings. He had founded the teaching of the inner Christ and the teaching of intuitional metaphysics. And I studied with him and learned about this sort of thing. And that's where I learned it.
Now, how do these spirits, lower entity spirits, glom on to you? I mean, do they already have to be present in your house? Or let's say, for example, you go out and you go to an antique store, and I've often been told, and you can disabuse me of this if it's incorrect, that that spirits will often inhabit an object. And so if you bring home, you know, you buy a chest of drawers that you like, you know, maybe an old bonnet chest from the mid-19th century, that could be possessed, that chest of drawers. You bring that into your house, and all of a sudden, you've brought them in. You've brought those spirits in. Is that how it happens?
That's one way that it can happen, yes. Definitely, because old things have old energies in them. They have thought forms, and they also have entities. Antique stores are filled with entities.
I can imagine. What about just walk? Let's say you're visiting someone in the hospital. I would imagine that there are a lot of earthbound souls wandering around in ERs.
Yes, they are. There's a lot of earthbound souls in hospitals, prisons, bars, mental hospitals, any kind of institution, educational institutions, schools, universities, churches,
everywhere.
Graveyards, obviously.
They're everywhere.
But to tell you the truth, not so much in graveyards as the other places that I mentioned.
Right, right. Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, but so when you're walking into any of these places that might attract, you know, earthbound souls, and are you saying that meditation, I am in control?
Yes, I think it's really important. It's like brushing your teeth in the morning. For everybody to close off their aura and open to the spiritual world, because you're going to have a better day if you do that. You'll simply not be attracting energies around you, untoward energies. I mean, there's a lot of energies. It isn't just entities. It's all the thought forms of humanity that are in the atmosphere. I call it environmental static. All the beliefs, habits, conditions, patterns of all the people around you at work, at home, everywhere. You're continually being bombarded with all these energies. And it's just a good idea for you to sort of live inside a spiritual cocoon. And that particular affirmation that I taught you will help you to do that.
So we are really in the midst of constant spiritual warfare, it sounds like.
Yes, we are. Yes.
What does someone do if – let me ask, back up and ask you this question. Are you able to tell remotely whether someone has a ghost problem?
Yes.
So let's say, for example, if I were to ask you to sort of tap into where I am, what do you need me to tell you? Do you need a location?
Where are you, in your home?
No, this is a studio in Toronto, in a neighborhood called Liberty Village in Toronto, Canada.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Are you able to connect?
I don't sense any ghosts there, no.
All right. Well, that's encouraging. I'm told that the previous building, we moved here in April. We were in,
yes,
a much older building in another part of town, and there were apparently some ghost stories related to that. I never had any experiences, but my a friend here who hosts a show preceding mine had some remarkable experiences at the old building, where an old a colleague of his would visit from time to time.
Yes, in old buildings, that'll happen. Old theaters, any kind of old building will often be haunted.
All right. So, what does someone do if they're possessed, or if they have a loved one that's possessed and they want to help them?
You know, you can pray for other people, but ultimately they need to want to be healed themselves, and they need to want have enough. Sometimes it takes a lot of pain for a person to really to really be motivated to be healed, but and willingness to be healed, because people gain advantage. There's always advantages to being poor me. There's always, you know, they always get something out of it. But if they really are willing to be healed, then by using the self-authority affirmation that I just told everybody, and by using the astral entity healing prayer, they can be healed.
And so what happens do they have to constantly repeat that affirmation, or does it happen? Do they have like a spontaneous exorcism? What happens?
The fact is that if somebody has a possession or an oppression, I really recommend that they say, for example, the astral entity healing prayer, which I can say it right now if you want.
Yes, please do.
If they say it like 50 times a day and use the self-authority affirmation 50 times a day, then they will be on a healing path and they will be healed. So I can say the astral entity healing prayer right now. It goes like this, and you're speaking directly to the entity or entities that you want to heal. You just say, beloved ones, you are unified with the truth of your being. You are lifted in divine love. You are forgiven of all guilt and shame. You are healed and released from loss, pain, confusion, and fear. Divine love and light fill and surround you now. Attachment to the earth no longer binds you. You are free to go into the divine light now. Go now in peace and love.
Now, if the spirit is malicious, let's say, this individual was a real PR in life, and so nothing has changed in the astral plane. Are they willing to go, or are they going to just hang on for dear life? Well, not dear life, but are they going to just hang on no matter what?
Right. Yes, Richard, they do not always go into the light, at least not right away. Sometimes it takes some convincing.
And so then what do you do? Call in the heavy hitters? what do you do?
I do tend to call in the heavy hitters when I need help. I call in Holy Spirit. I call in the great Avatar Babaji. I call upon various divine masters, teachers, Jesus Christ. I call upon various beings of light to assist me with the healing.
What are your thoughts on the Catholic rite of exorcism? Does it do any good?
I imagine it probably does, or they wouldn't be doing it. I don't know too much about it. I don't know how it goes exactly. But if they are asking the spirit to leave, you know, the spirit will eventually leave, but the question is, where is it going to go? Exorcism in general means driving out evil spirits, quote unquote. First of all, most of the spirits are not evil. Most of them are just lost and confused and looking for a way out. Secondly, if you drive them out, they'll just go somewhere else. They'll go bother your mother-in-law or your sister or a dog or a child. They'll go someplace else. So that's why it's important to heal them permanently, to send them into the divine light.
You mentioned that if we are possessed by a spirit, we can become depressed or lethargic or just physically ill, mentally ill perhaps. But are there other ways that they can be harmful to us? Should we fear ghosts?
There is no reason to ever fear anything if you know how to heal it. I've taught you how to heal it. There is no reason to ever fear. Now that you know that all you need to do is just use some simple prayers, I have never feared any ghost. I've never been afraid of any kind of horrendous poltergeist. Or, you know, there's a lot. I could tell you stories probably all night about different exorcisms that I and my students have done. But the reality is none of it was done out of fear. It's all done out of love, because everyone wants love. Even the most desperate demonic being, their motivation is love. Everyone's motivation is love. They want attention. They want love. They want acceptance. If you give them love and help them, they will go into the light.
Susan, is there another type of ghost? What I'm thinking about is, the classic... someone sees a man in a top hat descending the staircase at exactly the same time every day, as if it's some sort of an echo, like that
right.
Ghost doesn't have consciousness. So what's going on there? Is that just some sort of a reverberation from the past? What is that?
No, that's actually a ghost. Those are what they call echoes, or those repeating tapes, or whatever they call them, repeating videotapes. Those are ghosts. They are stuck on a treadmill.
But does that ghost have...
Now, what kind of hellish existence is that, to be stuck on a treadmill?
Right.
And I ask ghost investigators, what are you doing? How are you helping these beings who are in torment? You just want to go there and take pictures and take EVPs or whatever those things are called and help them move on, for goodness sake. These people are in torment.
So that type of ghost, that echo, that ghost has consciousness, is what
yes.
you're saying. It does.
Yes.
And they can be helped.
Anything that is stuck, stranded, lost needs help, needs to be helped, sent into the light.
Well, Dr. Susan Chomsky, I appreciate your time tonight. I'm wondering, I have one more favor to ask. Would you be so kind as to email me those affirmations and prayers? And perhaps I could, if you would permit me to post them those online so people can access them?
Most certainly. Absolutely.
That would be wonderful. Well, listen, thank you for your time. Again, the book is The Power of Auras. And I appreciate you spending some time with us here tonight.
Right, and my website is www.drsusan.org.
drsusan.org. Thank
right.
you. Have a good evening.
Thank you. You have a wonderful evening also.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you, Tim Spreen, for production. Back next week, Dr. James DiEugenio back on the JFK beat as we commemorate the 50th anniversary. In the meantime, don't be afraid. There's nothing concealed that won't be revealed, nothing hidden that won't be made known. What you hear in the dark, speak in the light. What I say in a whisper, proclaim from the housetops. Move over, Aphrodite. I'm coming home. Good night.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.